Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com, and this is Anti-War News for Friday, November 4th, 2022. First story at the top of AntiWar.com today. The U.S. and South Korea extend massive aerial war games after North's missile launches. So the U.S. and South Korea have decided to extend these major war games they are holding after North Korea put on a massive show of force in response to these drills. So the U.S. and South Korea, they started this exercise known as Vigilant Storm on Monday. And it's initially scheduled to run 5 days. So Monday through Friday, it's being held 24 hours a day. It's a huge aerial war game. It's the largest ever iteration of these drills. It involves about 240 warplanes. They're planning 1,600 sorties, which is apparently the largest they've ever planned for this drill. So, you know, they started this drill on Monday. North Korea made clear that, you know, they view it as an exercise for a war on them. And they said that they would respond. And they responded in a pretty big way. On Wednesday, they launched 23 missiles, which is said to be the most they've ever fired in a single day. They also fired over 100 artillery rounds on the same day. And then on Thursday, they launched about at least six missiles. So Lloyd Austin announced the extension of these Vigilant Storm exercises after a meeting with his South Korean counterpart, Lee Jong-soop. He said that after consulting with him, they decided to extend the drills. And it's not clear how long they're going to be extended, but North Korea is already warning of more consequences. This is from a North Korean official that said, quote, "The irresponsible decision of the U.S. and South Korea is shoving the present situation caused by provocative military acts of the Allied forces to an uncontrollable phase," end quote. During their meeting, Austin told Lee that the use of nuclear weapons by North Korea would result in the end of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. According to the Pentagon, Austin said, quote, "Any nuclear attack against the United States or its allies and partners, including the use of non-strategic nuclear weapons, is unacceptable and will result in the end of the Kim regime," end quote. So tensions have been growing on the Korean Peninsula throughout the year. As I've been going over a lot, Kyle Anzalone has really been on top of it over at the Libertarian Institute. Kind of this tit-for-tat U.S. and South Korean war games. North Korea fires some missiles or, you know, just the rhetoric is very high. Just everything is very tense on the Korean Peninsula. And it came after the U.S. and South Korea began conducting war games after a long pause. And Pyongyang has fired, North Korea has fired a record number of missiles in 2022, the most in a single year. And the pause in U.S.-South Korean war games, that came as a result of the diplomacy between the Trump administration and North Korea. Of course, Trump met with Kim. And although not much really happened after that, it did really cool tensions down for a while. Again, they weren't doing war games and there wasn't any missile tests. But the Biden administration, they're refusing to change their approach to the North. They're still calling for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And that's really just a non-starter for talks with the North. And the U.S. and South Korea, another factor in all of this is the fact that Yoon Suk-yeol, who is the new South Korean president, he came into office back in May. And he vowed that he would take a harder line on the North. And since he came in, the U.S. and South Korea have strengthened military ties. And again, he vowed to take a harder stance than his predecessor, Moon Jae-in, who is a proponent of Korean unification. For a minute there, under Moon and Trump, it looked like there was a good chance for some kind of peace deal and an official end to the Korean War that still hasn't been technically declared over. But that's all, you know, that seems like it's far behind us now with these tensions so high. So expect, we'll probably see reports soon of more South Korean missile tests, and things are just going to keep getting really tense in that area, just like every other part of the world, it seems like. All right. The next one here, senators vow support, bipartisan support for Ukraine after the midterms. So Senators Rob Portman, he's a Republican from Ohio, and Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, they visited Kiev on Thursday. They made the trip to Ukraine, and they pledged that there will be strong bipartisan support for providing massive amounts of aid after the upcoming midterm elections. Coons said, quote, "I am confident that bipartisan, robust American support for the fight of the Ukrainian people will continue in Congress," end quote. So supporters of Ukraine in Washington have been concerned after House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that a Republican-controlled House won't be willing to write a blank check for Ukraine. But other Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, who's the leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, they've been trying to downplay the concerns, insisting that the aid will continue to flow unimpeded. While in Ukraine, Coons and Portman met with the President Zelensky, and Portman said that he vowed the U.S. will be backing Ukraine until it achieves victory, which for Zelensky and his government means driving Russia out of all of the territory it controls, which includes Crimea. Portman wrote on Twitter, quote, "I said the U.S. must remain committed to aiding Ukraine to victory. I believe a Ukrainian victory is necessary to reaffirm the importance of the sovereignty of free nations and the importance of upholding international law around the globe," end quote. After meeting with Zelensky, after the meeting, Zelensky described these two senators as true friends of Ukraine and said that they support a joint victory. So somebody pointed out in the comments that Portman is not up for re-election. So he's going to be gone come January when they swear in the new Congress. So while the Republicans, overall Republicans are still expected to support aid for Ukraine, enough of a majority, I think, that it's not really going to make much of a difference. But there was 57 House Republicans voted against the $40 billion Ukraine aid bill that was passed in May. So that's a small group for the House, but that's still a significant number. No Democrats voted against it. And more, I think, are probably questioning the policy. I know a lot more Americans are, just ordinary people, as inflation, just everything we're dealing with prices, and we're just shipping billions to Ukraine. So hopefully, you know, that puts pressure on them to change or make a difference. Ukraine is expecting Republicans to keep sending weapons at least, but they're a little worried that they're not going to send all this money that they want for their budget, which we're going to get into a little more in the next story here, which is Ukraine. Ukraine's parliament approves its 2023 budget that has a $38 billion deficit. So it has a record high $38 billion deficit. They're calling it a victory budget. Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said after the vote, quote, this budget will do everything to bring victory closer. It was with this philosophy that we drafted this budget, end quote. So he's saying that the budget includes about $27 billion for military and security spending. So that's what Ukraine is going to spend on its own military and security. And kind of to put that figure in perspective, the U.S. has, so the Pentagon has said that the U.S. has pledged $17.9 billion in military equipment, in arms for Ukraine. That's what they're pledging in weapons and other equipment to ship there. But according to the German-based Kiel Institute, and I guess this is taking in other factors, other types of military aid, training, and things like that into account, they're saying that total U.S. aid for Ukraine since January 24th is the date that they used, which is a month before the invasion. But there wasn't much in between January 24th and February 24th. I mean, the vast, vast majority of it would be after the invasion. But they say it stands at about $27 billion. And that's less than a year. And that's what Ukraine is going to be spending on its own military for the 2023 budget. Now, with the $38 billion deficit, they're expecting the U.S. to pay most of it. He's previously said, the Ukrainian prime minister, that he expects the U.S. to hand over $18 billion for the deficit. And the EU and the IMF are going to make up the rest. So this is kind of something, when we say Ukraine's worried about, they might not get all this budgetary aid, this is really what they mean. I mean, they're literally just, whole government is reliant on just getting cash from the U.S. And, you know, kind of with these concerns about Republicans, as I've went over quite a bit, Congress, they, according to a report, it was from NBC News, lawmakers from both sides, Republicans and Democrats, they're looking to pass a new Ukraine aid bill before the new Congress is sworn in January that would cover the entire year. And the number being floated is about $50 billion. So we might see that happen. I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than $50 billion. And that this budget deficit money, this $18 billion, is expected to be in there, I would guess. So if they pass that, then they don't have to worry about it. But Ukrainian officials have said, okay, well, that's good. But what about the years after that? Because, you know, they expect this war to go on for years and years, and they're going to want all this aid and funding from the U.S. And Zelensky, he's asking also for another $17 billion from international donors on top of the $38 billion for next year to cover reconstruction projects that he wants to start. All right. I just want to take a moment to mention again our sponsor, How the West Brought War to Ukraine by Benjamin Ablo. It's a great short book about the U.S. and NATO provocations post-Cold War that led to the current situation that we see today. And if, you know, I've been talking about this book for a while. If you've read it and you like it, please, to help him out, you can go review it on Amazon. It's also available at Barnes & Noble, and I think Barnes & Noble's website, and I believe Goodreads is another place where you could buy it. So you could go give reviews there. And just to give you the rundown here of the people that have that endorsed the book and wrote blurbs for it. I mean, you have Chaz Freeman, John F. Matlock Jr., who's a former ambassador to the Soviet Union, who's been really an important voice today, because he's saying that he thinks this war could have been prevented if Ukraine fulfilled the Minsk Accords and declared neutrality and said no to NATO advisors and things like that. Douglas MacGregor, John J. Mearsheimer, and Noam Chomsky as well. He's on the cover. So yeah, I mean, it's just endorsed by a lot of great people. You could purchase the hard copy for $10. The Kindle version is $3.99. And soon there's going to be an audiobook, and I'll definitely let you know when that comes out. So I know a lot of people, that's how, you know, most, maybe not most, but that's how a lot of people read books these days, is the audiobook. But yeah, go review it to help support Mr. Ablo out. He's really working hard to get this message out to a lot of people. Okay. Next one here. Let's see. The IAEA says that it sees no signs of a dirty bomb at Ukrainian nuclear sites. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has found no traces of undeclared nuclear activity at sites in Ukraine where Russia alleged work was being done to create a dirty bomb. And a dirty bomb is a conventional explosive mixed with nuclear material. The IAEA issued a statement on Thursday that said its inspectors examined three sites in Ukraine at the request of the Ukrainian government and did not find any indications of undeclared nuclear activity or materials at these locations. So Russia began warning that Ukraine was preparing to use a dirty bomb towards the end of October. And Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, he even spoke with his Western counterparts about the allegation. Russia also brought the issue to the UN and said that its forces were preparing to work under radioactive contamination. So Ukraine has, you know, strongly denied it. The U.S., the U.K. and France, they issued like a statement basically saying Russia is lying and that they might be using it as a pretext to escalate, which I don't think is really right, because Russia, you know, they don't need reasons to escalate. They're not concerned with what the West thinks anymore. I think that's pretty clear. But it's a strange situation. I mean, Russia was really like warning about it. So maybe they did get some kind of intelligence that they thought Ukraine was trying to make a dirty bomb or exploring the idea of it. But the Ukraine invited the IAEA to check out these sites. So if they had something to hide, they wouldn't have done that at these particular sites, or they cleaned it up already before they came. But I just wanted to write a follow-up on this because I was covering these Russian accusations. And of course, you know, with the talk of the dirty bomb, that led to more talk of nuclear weapons. But this week, the U.S. has said that they've seen no sign that Russia's made any kind of decision to use nukes in Ukraine. And Putin said last week that he doesn't have any plans to. So next one we got here, China. China's foreign minister says that South China Sea claimants should jointly resist the U.S. So this is Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. This was reported by the South China Morning Post. So he's saying that the claimants, all the countries that lay claim to areas of the South China Sea, should resist U.S. intervention in the issue. China, as well as Taiwan, the Philippines, Vietnam, Brunei, and Malaysia all have overlapping claims to the South China Sea. And the U.S. has inserted itself in this maritime dispute and formally rejected most of China's claims in 2020. And that was done by the Trump administration, and that was reaffirmed by the Biden administration. So if you're watching the video, I have a map here of all the areas that these countries claim, and China's is the biggest, as well as, well, Vietnam's is pretty major too. It's that blue line that really extends out very far. And Taiwan also claims the same areas as China. But you see, you know, they're all overlapping. All these Southeast Asian countries have overlapping claims. And really, the U.S. position is just against China's claims. So they're not really picking a side. But the U.S. has rejected China's claims under the framework of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. It's a treaty. The abbreviation is UNCLOS. And it's an international treaty that defines the rights of nations to territorial waters. And now, while the U.S. is using this treaty to reject Beijing's claims, the U.S. is not a party to the treaty, as it has never been ratified by the Senate. And that's something that Wang mentioned in his remarks. He said, quote, "Some countries not only refuse to accede to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, but also concoct the Indo-Pacific strategy to compile exclusive small circles, engage in close provocations at sea, show off forces, endanger the peace and tranquility of the sea. This should be jointly resisted," end quote. So what he's referring to when he says the Indo-Pacific strategy, that's something that the Biden administration released, I believe, back in February, earlier this year. And the document, it calls for a greater U.S. presence in the region to counter China, with a focus on building alliances and boosting partnerships. Wang, interesting, I thought this quote from him was very interesting. He said this back in April, that you know, such an effort, U.S. alliance building in the region, could lead to a what he called Ukraine-style tragedy. You know, so he's drawing some parallels there to NATO expansion and things like that. And another aspect of the U.S. involvement in the South China Sea dispute is the U.S. naval operations in the disputed waters. Since the Obama administration, the U.S. has sailed warships close to Chinese-controlled islands in the waters, raising tensions with Beijing. The U.S. has also cited a 2016 international tribunal ruling. Oh, so when the U.S. rejected their claims in 2016, an international tribunal sided with the Philippines against China in their claims to certain areas of the South China Sea. So the U.S. also cited that. And that ruling was made under UNCLOS as well. And Wang, he hit out at that ruling. He called it an abuse of arbitration. So clearly China does not agree with it. But the U.S. and the Philippines, they recently held war games in the region. Around 3,500 troops stormed a beach in the South China Sea near a disputed reef. So I guess that could be simulating capturing some of these islands, rocks, and reefs from China. And the U.S. and the Philippines are treaty allies, and the U.S. has warned China repeatedly that their mutual defense treaty applies to attacks on Philippine vessels in the South China Sea. So once in a while, there's like a little standoff between China and the Philippines around these disputed rocks and reefs in these waters. And whenever that happens, the U.S. comes out and says, hey, if you guys fire on, you know, Philippine boats or something happens, you know, we'll go to war over it. It's really, you know, something how strongly they come out and say things like that. So there's always a chance of a flare up here. And I wrote a pretty extensive article about it like 2 years ago that I'll link to in this article. If you want to go check that out, this was like when I was writing more opinion pieces, but it's called "The U.S. Has No Place in the South China Sea Dispute." So you know what my stance is from the title. All right. So the next one here, this is interesting. It's from Politico. It's titled "Biden Froze Out China's Ambassador. He May Regret That." So China's ambassador to the U.S. just became one of the more powerful people in the Chinese government. So this is Qin Gang, and he arrived in Washington to be the ambassador to the U.S. back in 2021. And now it looks like, it's not for sure yet, but it looks like he might become China's new foreign minister. According to this political report, and I remember reading similar things, he was given the cold shoulder by the Biden administration. He couldn't really get meetings with high-level officials. They were limited to just a handful of U.S. officials. And one of them said that the short list included Kurt Campbell, who is Biden's top Asia official on the National Security Council, and Laura Rosenberger, the National Security Council's senior director for China. That narrow access came despite repeated requests to meet with more senior administration officials. And this is anonymous sources to Politico. The White House is rejecting the characterization, and they're saying that senior officials regularly engage with him. But Bonnie Glazier, who is she's often cited, she's the Asia program director at the German Marshall Fund. She said that she heard similar accounts about Qin's DC reception. So it looks like he was interesting because I followed him pretty close because, you know, at the time, this is what I do. I really follow the U.S.-China stuff very closely. When he first came to Washington, he really brought like a message of good relations. But as, you know, things went on, he kind of got a little more and more pessimistic. And I guess, you know, this is probably part of the reason why. But I quote him a lot because back in January, he said explicitly, you know, U.S. support for Taiwan, what he calls, you know, their independence forces. If the U.S. keeps increasing that support, he said it will lead to war between the U.S. and China. So, you know, that's what China's saying. And nobody's really taking their warning seriously, it seems like, because it appears that the attitude in Congress is that they have to arm Taiwan now. The attitude is that they didn't give Ukraine enough weapons. They didn't support Ukraine enough. That's why they got invaded, even though it's clear that, you know, a major part of why this war was launched by Russia was because of how much Ukraine was in NATO's orbit, how it was becoming a de facto NATO member. All right. So we left up the one from yesterday about the U.S. saying that Iran is not trying to build a nuclear weapon. And then the last one we put up here, this is from Al Jazeera, interesting report. The U.S. military donation misuse in Guatemala going unchecked. So this is a U.S. government watchdog report saying that the U.S. lacks concrete policies to properly document and address alleged misuse of military equipment donations in Central America. So between the U.S., the Pentagon, and the Department of State, the U.S. has provided more than $66 million in security assistance to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras from 2017 through 2021. And there's multiple allegations of equipment misuse, but they don't really have a way to track them. Basically, they're sending this stuff, and they don't know what it's being used for. And this is from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. So it's, you know, kind of similar to Ukraine, although 66 million doesn't sound like much. It's mostly, I think, the big items are like vehicles and stuff. But yeah, it's just another misuse. Yeah, here. So the findings came just 3 weeks after the Pentagon donated 95 vehicles to the Guatemalan army for use in border security, despite past misuse of U.S. armored jeeps donated to the Guatemalan Ministry of the Interior in the border region as well. So there is alleged misuse between 2018 and 2021 involving some of the 220 Jeeps that the Pentagon gave Guatemala. But anyway, so it's just another example of how they really don't keep track of this stuff. That's it for the news for today. We have a lot of good viewpoints, including one from Ted Snyder about that the U.S. concluding that Iran is not building a bomb, and he goes into it more extensively than I did, and he's the one that found it in that Nash the nuclear posture review that they said that. So go check that out. Marjorie Cohn at Truth Out, we have one from her. So a good spotlight here from Colonel Douglas McGregor at the American Conservative. So go check all that out. I know there's a lot to read, but we got a lot of information. Also, the picture story is about the new members of the Knesset that won in Israel's election, and they're pretty extreme, and they seem like bad news. But that's it for me for today. That's it for me for the week. I'll catch you after the weekend. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, Odyssey, Rumble, if you want the video. Download wherever you listen to podcasts. And you could leave reviews, too, in like Apple Podcasts. That helps. And share it with your friends on social media and all that good stuff. But that's it. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you after the weekend.